Today is the day today is the 19th of March 2025, and this is our first show, Monica and myself, and it's like being in school the very first day, so we're a little bit nervous and hope not to screw up too much. And we want to go through what brought us here in the first place, the long path that brought us here, which started when we started waking up basically to the realities in this world. And then there was one famous or infamous video that really brought us up like a rocket. And that was Sorry, Mom, I Was Wrong About the Holocaust, which was in 2016 when my dear sister Monica visited me in the summertime. And we produced a number of videos. And that one video just sort of blew our opponents out of the water because it just was so short, so simple, and went straight to the heart. And I've got Monica with me now, so why don't you say a few words,
Okay.
Monica?
Greetings, everyone, and welcome. This is episode one of Those Darn Schaefer Kids. And yeah, like Alfred gave the date and all that. And we would like to, first of all, give some thanks. And Alfred didn't say his last name. That's Alfred Schaefer there on the screen. And my name is Monica Schaefer. And some thanks are due. Now, first of all, I would like to say a huge thank you to the FTJ media crew, and primarily there, Dave Gaharie. He was very generous with his time, taking us through, holding us by the hand, basically spending many hours with us, guiding us. And it's a fantastic system that his tech guru Josh has set up, and we want to thank the crew at FTJ Media for that, for this help. And that's where we're broadcasting out of, is FTJ Media. So yeah, that's the first thanks. Second thanks is to Frederick C. Blackburn. He's also known as Blackbird Nine, because he's the one who invented or came up with that moniker, say, Those Darn Schaefer Kids, the when he was had us on for the first time on his show together, I think it was. And that kind of stuck, and it was an affectionate way, I think, to refer to us siblings. And so when we were trying to come up with a name for this show, you know, we brainstormed and thought of many different things. And Those Darn Schaefer Kids, we really like that for a number of reasons. One being that it's, well, like Alfred, you were saying that, you know, when we were children, we may have been a bit whatever, you know,
Yeah, well,
children
yeah.
are.
I'll put it
Go
this way:
ahead.
that I like that. When I heard that the first time, Those Darn Schaefer Kids, I says, "Yeah, you know, that sort of awakes our juvenile fighting spirit as we knew it when we were young." I mean, let's face it: when we were young and we knew somebody in the neighborhood who was making an ass of not only us but all of us, what did we do to that person? Well, we knew what we had to do to settle the score. Okay, and now we are waking up to understanding that a little vermin, a parasite, has been making an ass not only of the Germans with their silly, ridiculous, infantile superstition known as the Holocaust, but these parasite, these Jews, or this bad code, yeah, is making an ass of the entire planet Earth. All human beings on this planet are being made an ass of. For example, the Africans. It wasn't, they're supposed to believe it was us white people that brought in slavery and so forth. No, slavery was a 100% Jewish operation from start to finish. There's been more white slaves in human history than black slaves. How many people know that? I don't know,
No,
hardly anybody
no.
knows that, you know? And this list goes on and on and on. And the most recent thing that has affected all of us, this pan-plandemic, this corona nonsense. I mean, the corona, those letters are, those are six letters. And if you add them up, you know, like C being 3 points, A being 1 point, and so forth, it is 666. They basically spell it out for us, and still we fall for it. And that is sort of a feedback proof for them. That is how stupid they have made us. Yeah, and that's
okay,
sad
Alfred.
Situation.
We're gonna definitely get into all those things.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, I'm gonna go have a great show.
Well, actually, Dave, before you go, why don't you just say a few words? Because I want to go through these, you know, thanking everybody, and you were primary there to get us on. So, before you go, just say a couple of words.
I didn't do anything. We had fun. And it's great to have you two on FTJ. I mean, well, folks are going to find out about you guys. And
you're being very humble. You are being very humble and modest. And you and Dave Gahary works incredibly hard. As
can I say something?
Josh.
I think Dave Gahary, I think you one thing that one of your great accomplishments in the past has been your role in the USS Liberty and like just from what I know, you know, and your role in exposing the what USS Liberty was all about, you know, it's so important, and a lot of people don't understand the importance of that event.
That's right.
Which had that not gone through the way it did, we would not have had a 9/11. Had 9/11 not gone through the way it did, we would not have had this pandemic, and so forth and so forth. So there's a lot we're going to be talking about in the future.
Yes,
for sure.
Your levels of expertise.
Thank you very much, Monica and Alfred. And really, it was nothing. We had a lot of fun.
Yeah, we did.
Started. So have a great show. And I'm going to get out, and thank you to Josh as well. And it's looking good.
Well, thank you, and we'll talk to you later, Dave. See you later.
Bye, Dave.
Okay, now here we are, the threesome.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks. So really, I want to go through these. We have some kind of taken care of some, you know, we're going to introduce ourselves, Alfred, and the thanks are not done yet. I have a few other gratitude statements to make. And so we'll just get through that. And then we'll tell a little bit about ourselves, how we got here, and what our goal is with this show. You know, or do we have a plan? How often? What are we going to do with it? That's kind of, today is the introduction. And like the first day of school, you know, where everybody's kind of wide-eyed and figuring it all out. We're not going to do too many extra sort of technical things today, like bring in video clips or this kind of thing, but we will in the future, that kind of thing. But anyway, so I was saying thank you to Blackbird 9, and he has a show currently on Republic Broadcasting Network called the Saturday Snack Shack. And he used to have a show called Breakfast Club. That series, very, very educational. So if you haven't already acquainted yourself with Blackbird 9 or Frederick C. Blackburn, I encourage people to do so. And so the reason I bring him up now is because he came up with the name, Those Darn Schaefer Kids, which we have now adopted for the name of this show. So another person to thank for, if you noticed on the website, the thumbnail image for our show is a collage, which is a wonderful collage, which we owe thanks to Red Ice TV or Red Ice Radio. It's Henrik Palmgren and Lana. Henrik and Lana, they're a wonderful team who have been on this path for quite a few years of telling the truth. And a number of years ago, when we were going to be their guests, Henrik came up with that collage. Actually, I'm just going to pull one from the shelf here. It's this one. So everything is in here. You know, you've got the Twin Towers of the 9/11 event, and you've got a brain being scrubbed with a dish glove. You've got a bar of soap there, and you've got a shrunken head, and you've got all kinds of things in there that all pertain to the story of what is it that Alfred and I, first of all, how we woke up to the fact that we're being lied to en masse. And then it just connected a bunch of dots all in one nice collage. So that we want to thank Henry and Lana of Red Ice TV. They are wonderful people who have been on this truth-telling journey for quite a long time. And then, okay, I've already thanked Dave, Josh, the FTJ media crew. So what's our purpose here? And then we want to go into our background. And I thought maybe, Alfred, you and I can talk a little bit about our own awakening story and maybe about our family background and whatnot, or we could talk about how often are we going to do this show. So maybe we'll do that first because it's just a shorter conversation. Right now, we don't have a definite plan for frequency, but we're thinking maybe every second week and the length of 2 hours maximum, we thought, for the show. And it could be that we go more often. It could be that we go less often. But the important thing, I think, is that we have a consistent time, that Wednesday seemed like a good day for us. And this time of day, it works for Alfred, who is residing in, he lives in Germany. And I live on the west coast of British, well, not the west coast of British Columbia, sorry, the westernmost province of Canada. So I'm on Pacific time. We are normally 9 hours apart in our time zones. Right now, temporarily for a couple of more weeks, we're 8 hours apart with this silly time change that we don't do all at the same time and we shouldn't do at all. Like, you know. So anyway, yeah, that's what we thought for so far, but we will endeavor to always put the next planned show onto the schedule on FTJ Media so that if people are interested in seeing our shows that they could, I think the process is they click on that to be alerted to it or whatever, or it just says upcoming and when and all that. And we will have guests, we'll have panels, we'll figure out sort of a theme for each time, like what do we want to talk about, not just everything and anything, but maybe have a theme. Maybe this time we talk about, you know, the mass graves in Canada, or another time we talk about like the USS Liberty, or another time we talk about World War II history and really dissect that a little bit more in depth, or whatever it is, or, you know, that we want to kind of try to focus on themes. So we will invite guests, and we'll occasionally play video clips of Alfred. Has made some excellent educational videos in the past, and so on and so forth. So, Alfred, what do you think? Should we tell a little bit about where we come from, where we grew up, our family background, all that? Why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, okay. We grew up in, Monica still lives in Canada. I'm the only one from our family who moved back to Germany, and it was, I was only supposed to be a sort of a forget some work experience outside of Canada. That was my intention back then, but I ended up getting stuck here because everything worked out so well. I would have been a fool to leave the job I had gotten after applying for work here in Germany. But and also I was born in Germany. My older brother was born in Canada. My parents were back in Germany just for a couple of months to visit the old country when I happened to be born. And then the other siblings in our family were all born in Canada. Why don't you, Monica, to explain our growing up in the Arctic and so forth, or my dad's, because you've written it up in your book so nicely. And why don't you go through that part, our Arctic experience?
Yeah. So the whole reason why we are even Canadian, Alfred and I, is because my dad fell in love with the Eskimos. When he was a little boy, he received a book as a gift from his older brother, and it was about the Eskimos of Greenland, actually. Now, we're not in Greenland, but still, it was the Eskimos. And he was so fascinated by the Eskimos, who are now referred to more commonly as Inuit. Somehow they said it's politically incorrect to say Eskimos, but we're not very politically correct. And I know Eskimos who call themselves Eskimos, so I'll just call them Eskimos. Anyway, Dad was so fascinated by them that it was his lifelong dream to come to Canada. And so he did. Now, our father, he was born in 1919. World War II, he had already started med school, and then he went in between semesters onto the front as a medic, and then back to, you know, school, back to the front, back. So he spent his war years back and forth like that. That's my understanding of it. Correct me if I'm wrong, Alfred, if I'm saying anything that you think I'm
No, that's correct.
Not getting right. Yeah. So anyway, it was after the war ended, he did go into specialty internal medicine, and he fulfilled his lifelong dream of going to Canada in 1951. He'd already had his ticket for getting on the ship. Like at that time, people were still coming across by ship commonly, if they were going to leave the country and, you know, migrate, whatever. And then he met our mother also at Heidelberg in the med school. Our mom was also studying medicine because she wanted to take over her father's medical practice in Germany. And at that time, many of the men of my mother's generation had been killed in the war. So she really did not expect to be married, have a family or anything, because so many of the men were dead. That's just the way it was. So she did pursue a career, and her father was a doctor. So she decided she was interested. She wanted to also become a doctor and take over his practice. That was the intention. Then mom and dad met, and dad was supposed to leave 3 weeks later. And he goes, "Whoa, who's this beautiful woman?" And he delayed his passage. He managed to get his ticket swapped out for a ticket on another ship later. So they actually had 3 months together instead of just 3 weeks together to get to know each other. And they got engaged. Dad came over, and mom followed a year later in 1952. And, you know, came in Montreal, took the train across the country, and dad was in Edmonton at the time, and they got married basically as soon as he, you know, met her at the train station, went down to the Justice of the Peace and got married right away that day. In those days, you didn't not be married and then try to share a room somewhere. That just didn't happen, right? So, and they were already engaged. So that's how that happened. And then I'm not sure exactly when, I think it was very shortly thereafter that dad got a position in the high Arctic. And the first position was a Klavik in the, a Klavik, that would be the Western Arctic. And that's where our oldest brother was born. And then, like Alfred says, after that, it was like 2 year contracts. Dad was the doctor up there, and they had a wonderful time in this very, 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 very northern little tiny village, tiny hamlet, really. Dad was traveling by dog team and all this kind of stuff. So then they went to Germany in between that work contract and the next one, and that's where Alfred was born, like he says, in Germany. Then they came back to Canada for the next work contract, which was in the Eastern Arctic this time on Baffin Island in Pengnertung. My older sister, Alfred's younger sister, was born there. And then a few years later, they moved to Edmonton, Alberta, and that's where I was born. And our younger sister was also born in Edmonton. So the five children, our youngest sister, she died in a tragic mountaineering accident in 1988. And yeah, so anyway, that's the family story of how we came to be Canadian, is because of the love of the Eskimos. And this is a topic which, not right now, because we want to sort of continue with the flow of introducing ourselves, how we came to see what's going on in the world and all that. Oh, thank you, Josh, by the way. He just left us. I should have said thanks before he left. But anyway, he's the tech guru here who just left and wishing us well on our way here. So here we are now on our own. Anyway, another time I will talk about the whole situation about the North American indigenous people, or the North American Indians, basically what they call First Nations and all this stuff. That will be a whole nother topic of conversation. Maybe we'll touch on it a little bit later in this show today. But it is an interesting story where they are replicating their playbook, you could say, like they did for the Holocaust, and how they invented a lot of lies and a story was created and then hammered into the people's consciousness, and then laws made, legislation passed, and, you know, to forbid you from thinking any other reality. and then hence ending up in jail, which Alfred and I both ended up in jail. But that's part of our story. So why don't you now take over?
Yeah, like what Monica was just referring to now was what they invented this story there to guilt trip the white people in Canada. The Jews have invented narratives, stories that guilt trip us wherever we are, special guilt tripping. They guilt tripped, you know, because we have the Aryan stock people are the most inventive, ingenious peoples on this planet. I'm not saying that because we're white and we want to gloat or something, but that's the way it is. All the technological inventions that have allowed us to live as comfortably as we do today in you know, in this period of time in human history comes out of our creative genius. But one thing we also have is we have massive empathy, which far more pronounced than any other race on this planet. And the Jew has been a parasite riding on our back since as long as we've been around and since as long as there's been a thing called money. They have devised a, I call it an operating system to figure out how they can control this money, get a hold of this money, and get by as a parasitic entity. And we should never have allowed it to get as far as it has gotten, because now they have, as and it's written in one of their lines of code, you know, their operating system, where they call it people of Jewish faith. Their faith is an operating system for total psychopaths. And this line of code says that after we have squeezed everything out of the host's population, everything that we can possibly squeeze out, then we destroy them utterly and even destroy any memory of them. It's all written in their so-called holy books. And in Canada, because the Canadians cannot be blamed for gassing 6 million of these poor, innocent little Jews, they've concocted stories about how evil the white people were to the indigenous peoples. Okay, that was the Inuit or the Eskimos or the Indians, you name it. They have stories concocted with mass graves, sort of like the mass graves in Auschwitz, which nobody has been able to find. Nobody's been able to find any of these anywhere. But the same narrative, basically, against the Canadians. And the Canadian people are so they just cannot imagine being lied to by such a devious evil manner, and so they believe it. They swallow it. You know, they hope.
Actually, Alfred. On that note, I mean, a lot of people are not buying it. It's not universally accepted at all.
Well, I'm glad about that.
This is the thing, and I do want to get back to kind of our direction here.
Yeah.
Because this is a whole topic for itself, but. What I see happening is, you see, when the Holocaust narrative first got pumped out, there was a lot of dissent. There was a lot of dissent in Germany. There were just a lot of people going, no, this didn't happen. But this is hidden from us more and more. Like the mainstream direction, the mainstream schooling, the mainstream media, all the mainstream sources of information do not allow that to be seen, heard, or known about. And what I can see happening if we don't put a stop to this with the indigenous story here is that, and this mass graves or unmarked graves story, is that that is how they are rolling it. I'm watching it unroll in real time. And I can predict that if we don't stop it, we will stop it. We're going to turn the ship around. But anyway, if we didn't, if we just go along like, just, okay, well, life is still comfortable enough and I'm just going to, you know, keep my head low because I don't want to take any chances here and whatnot with what I'm supposed to say or not supposed to say, or it's, I might get, you know, lose my friends if I say too much about this in public or whatever, all these things. Well, then over time, their story, the one they want us all to believe, becomes more and more entrenched, and they've already introduced legislation. They haven't passed it yet, but it is on the books, legislation that has been brought to the to the House to forbid us, just like with the Holocaust. The wording is very similar, very, very, very similar. You cannot diminish the harms of, you know, talk about diminishing the harms of the residential schools. You cannot praise the residential schools. You cannot do anything sort of like with the National Socialist, that you're not allowed to say anything good about that time in our history in Germany, and you're not allowed to downplay the so-called Holocaust. Same playbook. And so over time, I can see that if another generation passes and we haven't actually nipped it in the bud and put a stop to this, the next generation will think that this unmarked graves and mass graves is, I got to turn this off. Sorry. Somebody was trying to call me there on Skype. Did that sound come through to you?
No, sir.
Okay, good. No. Just on my end here, I just put a stop to that. Somebody's trying to call me on Skype there. Anyway, and I hung up on them. Very rude is of me, isn't it? While we're on a live show here. So anyway, that's that. But we will definitely get into that in greater detail.
Yes.
Another time. And like you did with one of your brilliant videos, Alfred, when you said, let's reverse engineer the story of 9/11 to better understand how they brought us the lies of the Holocaust. You did that. You brought those two things together, and you thanked Larry, not Larry Silverstein. What was that other guy's name?
Michael Chertoff. Michael. I know he was one of my stars in one of my videos there.
Yes.
But thank you, Monica. That reverse engineering. And see, the Jews are not as brilliant as they like to portray themselves at. They always say we're jealous of them because they're just so smart and so industrious. No, they are so devious, and they use tricks that we wouldn't think of using because we're not that evil. And like we were talking about before, you cannot diminish the graves, the unmarked graves and blah, 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 because you hurt the feelings of the poor indigenous people. It's always about feelings. Somebody's feelings are being hurt. I remember, Monica, when we were just waking up to 9/11, and there was a big campaign in Canada where they had a few buses, I guess they had, you know, had paid architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, had paid for putting the big flyers on the sides of these buses or something. And I remember how the campaign to prevent that, or to try to prevent that, was that is hurting the feelings of the victims of 9/11. So any resistance to their lies is always hurting the feelings of somebody.
Yes.
You know, and it's just utter nonsense. But look at what they about us white people aren't even allowed to have any feelings. We are just evil, and we are now in the crosshairs to be exterminated. But you know, Monica, if I take a track record of somebody who, I like the old example of being thrown out of the pub, you know, if you were thrown out of the bar, Monica, the pub over 1,000 times, Monica, and you're whining and crying about the evil the barkeepers there, Monica, I would seriously ask you, look in the mirror and see if the problem might be the face that's looking back at you in the mirror. This is the Jews. Now, if the Jews think that they're going to pull it through because they've had such a long streak now, they've come so far. No, you have got to understand, or everybody has got to understand, it has come to the point that we find it today. It should never have been allowed to go this far, but it did go this far because the last huge onslaught against the entire planet was what we call the world wars, like World War II. And we were in such a traumatized state. And then it happened. It's just one moment in our human history where we made such progress in inventions and so forth that came primarily from like the plundering of the Germans, the Operation Paperclip, all the patents in Germany, all this, the what do you call it, the spirit of the Germans in their inventiveness, the ingenious inventions they had, was all taken out, robbed. Operation Paperclip, the biggest robbery in all of human history, was the robbery of all Germans' inventions in 1945. Then, and that enabled us to experience a real technological revolution, including the digital technology, which allows us to have this speech now. This is dialogue. You know, it's time zones apart, two different continents, and we can put it out on the internet. That all comes primarily out of the German spirit, like inventions and so forth. And that allowed us to be distracted for way too long. And the Jews were driving their agenda forward bit by bit by bit. Like you were saying before, when they started with their hoax narrative, at the first few times they tried it, they completely failed. There was just an uproar of what kind of nonsense is that? And then people had enough time had gone by after the trauma of, you know, 1945. Mm-hmm. And then they came up with that again, but we didn't take it seriously. Like they came out with this films, you know, Hollywood movies, you know, Schindler's List.
Well, actually, that's when people really did take it seriously, Alfred.
The
Holocaust film because they had been 70s. The point I was making, Alfred, is that there were resistors, but to listen to their narrative now, you would never know that there were resistors to this.
Yeah, of course.
The Jewish groups, organizations and whatnot. I mean, my lawyer told me all about this when we were going through our trial in 2018. And we should get into that story because we're not going to assume that everybody that's watching this knows anything about our background. Well, who the heck?
You're right.
But he was telling me that you know, the Jewish lobby groups in Germany lobbied hard for 10 years. I mean, I think before that they were already pushing for these things, but they lobbied hard to get this certain law passed in Germany. And then it ended up, it was called paragraph 130 in the German criminal code. And that's the one that they charged Alfred and I with. And so again, not everybody watching this, we want to attract new people, Alfred. And so we really do need to give an introduction to our own awakening and basically the story of what happened. Many of the listeners, they probably know it all and then, you know, tune out for a few minutes or whatever. But I think that so instead of getting right into the meat of all these things right off the bat, because then it's kind of like out of context if we have new viewers. And one, the main purpose, I mean, we've talked about this many times, the main purpose of the work we do, and it started with you doing your very educational videos. I mean, you didn't just do that for nothing. It was to educate people, to try to explain things, to show people how this is, what is what, right? Like your very first video, the 9/11 gatekeepers and controlled opposition. It's just so educational. Explains about opposition.
Yeah, I'll go to that.
But anyway, so who are we? What is our basic story? Like, you know, when I talk about we went to jail and all this, some people might be saying, "What? You went to jail for what?" So, like we already explained, we all grew up in Canada. Then Alfred reverse migrated, you could say. He's been living in Germany since you went back there in the mid-80s, I guess it was, when at first you didn't plan to actually live there permanently. It just kind of came about that way then, that once you were there and you traveled around, you did some epic trips into Africa and all over the place, cycling and driving buses and all kinds of stuff. Very interesting stories, Alfred. But anyway, then you end up married there and having a nice place, and that's where you live, you know, because sometimes people, when you did get out of jail, people would say to me, well, is he going to come back to Canada? I said, well, he lives in Germany. He lives there. He's been living there a long time. And anyway, running to Canada, like, we're communist here. I have friends who have left Europe, like they're from either the Netherlands or from Denmark or whatever. I have friends that moved to Canada, like maybe 20 years ago, and because they wanted to get away from what's going on over there in Europe. And then they discovered, oh no, it's worse here.
Yeah. I'll get into about my first video basically and how that led to
how did you wake up?
I'll tell you what
woke me up. Interesting.
Exactly. What woke me up was about 2010, I believe it was, seeing a short 15-minute video. I think it was Ed Asner who was playing as a lead role for Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And he was explaining WTC-7 in this video. And he did it in such a professional, convincing manner. And I realized, hey, he's explaining something. This is serious stuff. He's an engineer. And my job was basically engineering. Okay, I was working for IBM. And, you know, I'd spent several years in the development lab for IBM in Boulder, Colorado, and so forth. So then I realized this guy is explaining to us a major flaw in something that's happened here, and a crime, a huge crime, and nobody's doing anything about it. And then I realized, geez, this is if I don't look at it and just this is I got to find out more about this and do something about it, talk about it, because he's telling me about it, so I've got to spread the word. And that's how it started. And then so I was only focused on 9/11, you know, and then of course, you know, the WTC-7, that's the third tower that fell at, you know, 5:20 p.m. or something on that on 9/11. I wasn't hit by anything, you know. And then of course everything, the whole 9/11, the two big towers, they were blown up as well. And then I started blogging. I started going to, you know, websites like Foreign Affairs or Foreign Policy and so forth. And back then, you could do some serious commenting on the articles that they put out on the internet. And you can't do that anymore nowadays because they censor all it. You know, as soon as you become politically incorrect, they'll block you out of all these websites and so forth. But back then, they were actually very open and allowing you to do it. And these were websites where they were actually laying out their positions for their policies. Okay, why we have to attack Iran like right now and so forth. And I'd go in there and I'd start explaining things. And then I learned a lot during that time, because you know, this was all in English, of course, primarily for the American population. And there's people there, they were following what I was writing. And then sometimes I'd start repeating myself, because I'd say, I hate to repeat myself, but this, you know, think about what happened on 9/11 and blah, 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 blah. And when I apologized for repeating myself, I'd get the comments back from other people, Alfred, don't apologize. Just lay out your stuff, you know, lay it out. Come on, we need you. And this encouragement from people in the United States who saw that, hey, this guy in Germany, because I was my avatar was Alfred in Germany, and this feedback, hey, we need you, you know, keep doing it, that kept me going. And then finally I got deeper and deeper into this stuff, and then finally I had material on my desk, you would say, that I says, I've got to do something with this, like, and it was about the subject gatekeepers. Like, it was Noam Chomsky. It was a video I saw where Noam Chomsky was asked in a university in Florida what he has to say about WTC-7 and so forth. And his answer was so obviously just leading us away as a gatekeeper, like leading us like jibber jabber, not explaining anything, not answering the question, just he spent 5 minutes or 10 minutes telling us why we don't have to understand that, because he doesn't understand it, and it's just blah, 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 you know. And then I thought, in my head, I thought,
Alfred, I'll just interject there, because it's a very, very important point about Noam Chomsky, this highly intellectual guy who, by the way, both Alfred and I had, you know, spaces on our bookshelf full of his books. We just looked up to him so much because he was criticizing Israel and all this stuff, and he was a Jew, and we thought, wow, you know, I mean, he had really good books on various historical things and whatnot, but this thing about his point of, you know, we're not physicists, we're not, you know, architects, so we have to leave that for those experts to figure out. We have to, you know, let the experts, like, we would just be armchair physicists, so we are not qualified to analyze that and see something wrong with it. In other words, we're not qualified to think about it. Don't think about it. And
so, and his argument was basically, you should go to the institutions that are qualified, those very institutions that are all run by Jews, you see. So this is how the Jew, once the Jew has got all these vital points in our civilization in their possession, you can't go to an institution like MIT or something, because it's all run by Jews. I mean, you can't go to, you know, go to the synagogue and make your complaint there. You know,
Further this point, unfortunately, many people in our society have taken on that way of thinking. In fact, our very close relative, and I wrote about this in the book too, like, he basically said to us, well, we it's not up to us to figure out how that happened on 9/11. Like, we're not expert on that. And this guy is really, really, really smart. Like, he's got smarts, but he's been trained to think that we have to leave our thinking to the experts. So don't use your common sense anymore, right? That, unfortunately, this has pervaded our society from people like Noam Chomsky saying things like that.
That's right. You know, and so at the beginning, I was always actually taking Noam Chomsky, like protecting him kind of thing, because I was saying, well, I only figured this out very recently. How can I assume that he would know all that stuff? Because he's in his ivory tower there. He doesn't know. But then it was so blatant how he deflected attention away from the root cause and so forth.
He mocked
that suit. And then I saw another video where he was doing the same thing when it came to the JFK assassination. His response, I don't know if he even knew he was being recorded when he said that, but his response was something to the tune of, who cares if the official story isn't true? People die every day. So one day it was Kennedy. So what? This was his mocking that question. Who cares if what it really is, what really happened? It doesn't make any difference. People die every day. And then I realized, boy, that, okay. And then people would always, when I was blogging, the Americans would always tell me he is a gatekeeper and spell out a G-A-T, you know, in big letters, capital letters, until I finally realized, stop protecting this guy.
What is a gatekeeper?
Yeah. And the gatekeeper, this guy like Noam Chomsky, these people are, they spend a long time very tediously building up a following of people who have extremely high trust in him. And he was like, for Monica and me and myself, he was like a guru, like a real guru, like the Pope kind of thing, like a guru, you know, where he says we don't have to think because he does the thinking for us. That's the role that he played for us, until we realized, no, he has made an ass of us. He's the Pied Piper. He's leading us somewhere, and it's not good for us where he's leading us.
That's a very good phrase, the Pied Piper. But I would say that, we trusted him, not because we didn't want to think, Alfred. I would.
No, we did. We like couldn't that. Think. We but, were. We didn't. We couldn't think. We were. Monica, this indoctrination makes thinking very difficult.
Yeah, genius, it's true.
It's like George Orwell said. Yeah.
He wrote such good books. Like, I read several of his books. He wrote such good books on Central America. He wrote a good book, and he wrote good books that at the time, I mean, if I reread them now, which I can't because I threw them all out, I think I might have, you know, maybe I don't know what I did with them, but they're not in my home anymore. I don't want to have Noam Chomsky books in my home. But if I did reread them now, I bet I would read them with completely different lenses on.
But these good books were part of building up his the trust.
Yes.
He had to build up trust. And Monica, when we were on trial, we had, you remember the Volkslehrer? His name is Nikolai Nehling. He was here also.
He
used us to build up trust. And I completely believed him. I thought he was fantastic to have such a high caliber person who's fighting for us. But he is also a gatekeeper. He's running, he's working for the other side. And these are the concepts that very trusting people, unless you really understand what the Jew does and all the tricks the Jew has learned over the course of hundreds and thousands of years, actually, they have learned to know us better than we know ourselves, and they know how to trick us, to follow them, to believe them, to incapacitate our own thinking. All these words, you know, like Yuri Betsmanov, he was an officer for the KGB and had defected and went to the States and told us some very, very important things in his lectures that helped us a lot. And about how the Bolsheviks, how the Jews, when they devastated Russia just over 100 years ago, you know, the Russian Revolution, it was actually a communist Jewish revolution, takeover of the country, a slaughtering off of dozens of millions of the best people, okay? This is what the Jews do. This is why they have us in the crosshairs. They want to breed the world's population down, okay, so that nobody can have the brains anymore to even have a chance of seeing through their deceit and their lies. But of course,
that's back to Yuri Betsmenov.
Yeah, back to Yuri Betsmenov. And Yuri Betsmenov, okay, I kind of lost my train of thought there. But
you were going to say something about Yuri Betsmenov and how what he had told us then, and you just explained who he was. But
Yuri Betsmenov. Yeah, he said about the thinking. He says that people when we are demoralized to a certain point, we are incapable of forming clear thoughts anymore. And Yuri Betsmenov said very clearly, he says, you can take people to the concentration camps. I'm not talking about the, you know, Auschwitz, this nonsensical Hollywood stuff. I'm talking about the real evil death camps that were set up in the Soviet Union. He says, you could take people there and show them what's happening, okay? How the people are being slaughtered, tortured, killed in mass. And then they'll still not really understand what's causing that or who's behind it. They'll kind of go off to their play world. It's like our people now in our Western civilization. Why, how can it be that like this corona nonsense? I mean, they show us a picture of a fake little ball with spikes on it and say, that's a coronavirus and you need to get an injection. I mean, hey, this is the poison of the wells. They did a real thorough job this time. Plandemic with corona is nobody can tell us how many people they mass murdered with that, and they're still dying like it's a bioweapon. It acts slowly, you know, it'll kill you in 10 years and 5 years and 2 years, whatever. And why did how did they get away with it? For them, that's why in Israel during the corona time, the pandemic time, they were dancing and celebrating because they could see how the entire planet Earth, they're all running to their so-called doctors to get their poison injection. And they were celebrating because the Jews were making a killing. And their goyim were running and getting their death shots. This is what the Jew wants. He wants to exterminate
us. Back to what – so Yuri Betsmenov was saying, you can take them by the hand, show them, but still the people won't understand.
They won't.
They'll just glaze over.
They glaze over.
But he did say until the boot
– the military boot. Until the boot comes down on their neck. And then it's too late. Then they die. And all these people – Or then it's too late. Then they're too incapacitated. Yeah. Like it's too late. Like we could have this problem resolved in a civilized fashion overnight, basically, if we all could get our heads functioning again and stop putting up with this nonsense and speak the truth. You know, shout it from the rooftops. But so many people, they cannot. They're like little children. They run away and say, oh, you're okay, a conspiracy theory and blah, blah, blah. You know, yeah.
This is the epic big problem of our time. And how did we get here? Through lies and deceit from the Jews.
Yeah.
And so psychological warfare, like you said a moment ago, they know us better than we know us. And so this is the epic fundamental problem. How we got here is through this psychological warfare against us, so that so many of our own people are completely blinded. And just like Yuri Betsmenov described, you can take the people by the hand and show them these horrible places, spell it out for them. Now you spell it out for them that yes, people have died from the vax. Yes, many people have been vax injured. They're calling it other things when they die of cancer, heart attacks, this and that, children dying. Oh, it's normal now. And athletes dying on the field where it might've happened once a year before in a certain amount, you know, per population. Now it's like dozens, you know, so all these things you can show them and show them and show them. And why do they not get it? It's this psychological warfare, but this is what if we could figure out the answer of how to reach people, we'd have it licked right now overnight. Yeah, but this is what we're trying to do, right? Like
there's one more thing I wanted to bring up now. When I did my first video, it was 9/11 gatekeepers and controlled opposition. And then I made some content errors, you know, where I described things in the wrong way because I was still indoctrinated myself. Brainwashed.
Exactly.
I hate using the word brainwashed. I was indoctrinated myself still.
Brain dirtied,
Brain dirtied. I was 75% indoctrinated still when I made that first video. And therefore, I made these errors. I compared those evil Zionists with those evil Nazis. You know, I just did not understand yet that this
bad boy.
Yeah. And so I was being attacked for these errors that I made. After the videos had, I produced my first video in 2014, and about 2015, thereabouts, you know, I was being attacked more and more ferociously by people out there who simply were further in their own understanding of what, you know, what's going on here, because everybody starts somewhere. You got to make your first step. And so I was being attacked for these mistakes. And this was actually a blessing in disguise that I had made these mistakes, because then it forced me to make a video, because I can't, you know, once it's out there, you can't pull it back, you know, out of the internet. And then it forced me to make a video. It's called Police Raid and My Confession. And it was after they had confiscated my equipment here and so forth, raided me again. And I confessed that I was myself behaving like a programmed rat and used these errors that I made in that first video as proof that I was saying things that were just nonsensical. And that's an important thing. If you are, let's say you're an alcoholic, or you're a kleptomaniac, or you're a drug addict, whatever it is, you have something that you know is not right and you want to get it fixed. You will never fix yourself or heal yourself from this problem if you are too weak to admit that you have this problem, okay? If you're drinking like crazy, and then somebody says, hey, you should tone down on the alcohol. Well, what's your problem? I don't have an alcohol problem. Then you're not going to fix the problem. You have to be able to stand up and say, hi, I'm Alfred Schaefer. I have an alcohol problem, and I am here to get this problem fixed. Or, hi, I'm Alfred Schaefer. I'm a kleptomaniac. You better watch out with your stuff that you lay around, because I'll steal it just because I have to steal it. You know, you have to admit you have a problem, and then you can work at healing it.
Exactly.
And many of our people, Monica, people that are completely demoralized. They are so weak. They will run off and scream at you before they will admit they don't have the strength to stand up and say, yeah, maybe I'm believing nonsense. Maybe I have a problem. Maybe I've been indoctrinated.
That's a very, very difficult step. Very, very difficult step for people to make, especially if they've really dug in their heels.
Yes.
I mean, in our own family, you know, we have family members who, when Alfred and I started down this journey of awakening, they went the other way. And I think that then, because we became quite public and then ended up in jail and all this stuff, they went harder the other way because they just cannot. But I have an equivalent story to your, like, none of us learns everything overnight in one go, right? So for us, both of us woke up about the 9/11 story, and you know, I've got my own sort of story around that. But then, yes, within a couple of years, learning that lying was not invented in 2001, and lo and behold, they lied to us about that biggest taboo subject that, you know, you sure cannot look into, or else you're plain evil, is how the mainstream portrays you if you start to question it. And that would be World War II history, and in particular, the so-called Jewish Holocaust. But okay, but to stick with my point here, I wanted to give you my parallel story about, in my little short video, the Sorry Mom, I Was Wrong About the Holocaust, which is only 6 minutes long. I made a statement, which that was 2016. In 2025, I would not make that same statement. And it goes by pretty quickly. But I did have people in comments saying, oh, I quit watching it as soon as she said that. And what it was my statement about, oh, this reminds me now of the people, you know, the indigenous people of North America. They too were made to feel ashamed of themselves, and they too, blah, 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 blah. Now, I very purposefully gave you a little bit of background about why we're even Canadians. It was the love affair with the Eskimos that my dad had. And while we were growing up, by the way, we had people from the North come and stay with us in our home in Edmonton. So Eskimos stayed with us, and we it was wonderful. I mean, we loved them, and we loved the stories. My father had one of the biggest collections of soapstone carvings, like Inuit art, in our home. It was one of the biggest collections in all of Western Canada. And it was amazing, because when we had guests, Dad would tell all these stories, and that's when we heard all these stories. They were fascinating. Like, every single one of these soapstone carvings, Dad could, you know, tell a big story, interesting story. He was great with that. It was wonderfully interesting. And so I had, you know, we grew up with that. But then now I have a new understanding about, see, the Native people or so-called Native, so-called First Nations, and I say so-called, just think about the word Aboriginal and original. Think about the word normal versus abnormal, okay? So original, Aboriginal, that's another story for another time, getting sidetracked down a lot of different rabbit trails here. But anyway, what is going on now is that they are being instrumentalized, shall we say. The Native people of North America are being instrumentalized, just like the Black people in America are being instrumentalized by the usual enemy of humanity, and that would be organized Jewry, Jews, that they instrumentalize these other groups, incite hatred against the white race in them, and tell stories that are false. And so that we feel guilty, and like Alfred said, they know us better than we know us, and we do have this quality quite well developed in our race. Not every single person, but in general, we have this empathy, so we are easily made to feel guilty, and we are high trust as well in general. So high trust means we will believe what they tell us, and we have empathy, so we will feel guilty about what they tell us. So if they tell us that we genocided all these children in the schools, or that we, you know, threw Jews in gas chambers and World War II, and then they tell us these things, and boy, oh boy, the German people, when they were on their, brought down on their knees and prostrate by, you know, being bombed, like unbelievable devastation in Germany, and then they get to, you know, they could, like the Jews know too, that's when you can kind of reset the brain, as in give you a new narrative. And anyway, I'm all over the place right now, but my story about what you said in your first major video that you did, that 9/11 gatekeepers and controlled opposition, it was very educational, but there was that one mistake, and you had the Star of David and the swastika in a, you know, green screen or whatever, however you do that technically, above your shoulders, equating them as being evil together. So that was your mistake, because you didn't yet realize that, oh, they lied to us about World War II and about, you know, National Socialist Germany. And for me, it was that statement I made about, the poor indigenous people, that they were made to feel ashamed of and all that stuff. So now I would do that differently. But again, we wake up gradually. We learn things gradually. And then, you know, we have to always timestamp everything and allow other people for that too. So yes, there are controlled opposition who string us along, but then there are also genuine people who just don't know yet. So we have to be discerning and figuring all those things out. Back to you, Alfred.
Yeah. Anyway, going back to the purpose of what we want to do here is we want to reach people who are still believing some or all or some of these lies, in helping them to heal, basically come out of their condition. And nobody's alone, and we were all indoctrinated to some extent. There's very few people who did not fall for this nonsense. I mean, if we go back, how did they get away with 9/11? Why was there not an instant outcry? Because people were traumatized by that event. Some people will claim they knew right away what it was, kind of thing, but that's not very many. And I didn't hear.
No, it's
voices.
Very few. And if they did, no. Like the good example of, and I already mentioned him in thanking him for the moniker, Those Darn Schaefer Kids, that's Blackbird 9.
Yeah, he answered right away.
He ended up being severely punished for it, lost everything, right?
That's amazing.
And,
yeah.
And surely there were other people around him who had equal ability to think and see and deduce, but yet he was very alone among his cohort there where he was working. And so this is something about our human psychology, that we are very much a social, you know, where we are very afraid of stepping out of the crowd. And this is another aspect of how, you know, the Jews know us very well, and what makes us tick, and what makes us, you know, we're cohesive, which is great. When we are homogenous societies, then these qualities are very good for us. But when we are infiltrated by an enemy, these things get used against us.
This ritual defamation that Frederick Blackburn suffered there was actually it was even more intense or more severe than what you suffered, and that was very severe. I mean, because he really was out of everything then. I mean,
everything.
You see, and this is how the Jews do it. They try to punish all those who step off of the narrow path that they have laid out for us that mm-hmm. takes us straight to our collective slaughterhouse. You know, this is the situation we find ourselves in. And I know the guests that we want, we'll be looking for people to, you know, join us on our show, maybe bi-weekly or whatever. We haven't set that out yet in stone. But one thing that I know we'll be talking about a lot is not so much the current, exactly what's happening right now, but it's about helping, but people should tell us how they came out of the matrix and some of the things they experienced, because when people hear these experiences, then they will see themselves in, you know, they'll say, hey, I went through that also, you know, it'll help them to overcome the difficulties they're going through. Because we've got to come out. We're looking at this as a like one would diagnose a disease. You know, I always say what the Jews are doing with their power over the money which they've accumulated, they have taken this much, much farther than we should have ever allowed it to go. You know, if you have a couple of cockroaches in your kitchen and you say, oh, they're not so bad, they're not going to do much. And then one day you wake up and find out that your entire property and house and your whole city is full of cockroaches. Well, then you got to, you know, get rid of them. You just, you know, gas them or something. but with the Jews and their games they're playing, the Jews themselves are now not feeling comfortable with the situation they find themselves in. And they're gloating about their accomplishments, but this entire behavior that we're seeing now, regardless of where we look, is exposing the problem so clearly, so massively now, that our job has become easier and easier. Like, they will not win, okay? The truth is breaking through. And we want to just be a, you know, like, be a conduit or something for people to, you know, if they listen to our experiences, then they will see themselves in a similar situation. And we also want to remind it that some of our greatest brothers in arms have been people who came from the other side. I'll mention people, well, like Gerard Menuhin, for example, his book, you know, Tell the Truth and Shame the Devil, or JFH, Jews for Hitler. You know, he's a good mm-hmm. friend of mine now, really a good friend. And, he's come from the other side. Benjamin Friedman. See, people that came from the other side grew up in the synagogues, understood what this means, what they are learning, how they're being indoctrinated, and then understand this is gonna run against the wall. It's not gonna fly. It's not gonna work. So these people are often the most valuable people on our side to help us to reach more people. Because we've got to come out of this bad programming. Because I notice myself when I meet somebody, let's say at the market or something, and depending on how they react to certain words or certain whatever, I just look at them. If I realize they're still indoctrinated with this Corona stuff or the Holocaust or any of this nonsense, I cannot respect them. If somebody still believes those lies now, I just shake my head as if I'm looking to a retarded little child. Really, I cannot. I end all conversation there. I say, forget it. You've had your chance. The clock is ticking. You've had your chance. You haven't even made the first step. Goodbye.
I think Alfred, really, with this show, back to this, and we still haven't told the audience, in case we have new listeners here, what the heck happened with our story, our specific story. Yes, we've alluded to the fact that we were both in jail, but we should give a little bit more about that. But the people, I guess, that we need to reach are those who are becoming curious and just starting. And so, okay, if there are people out there who are just basically, they're not reachable, then we don't need to spend time.
No, forget them. Nature will sort them out. They will be sorted out through nature.
Yeah. So our basic story, and then I want to tell you, I've jotted down a couple of examples of people's waking up stories that I really like, and I just think they're valuable. Like you say, people's waking up stories are very, very interesting, and there are many different paths that people have then, you know, gone to, well, the old expression, all roads lead to Rome, but in this case, all roads lead to, you know, Tel Aviv or whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway, basically what happened with Alfred and I, so this will also tell a little bit the story, what's in that short 6-minute video. Sorry, Mom, I was wrong about the Holocaust. You know, once we started waking up, and we talked on the phone a lot, me from Canada, him from Germany, and because we were going on this journey together, we did talk a lot on the phone, because, you know, it's, oh, did you see this? And did you hear that? And, you know, just doing that kind of thing. And then one day I said to Alfred, geez, I wish I could say sorry to Mom for the things that I said to her when I was younger, when we were learning in school about this Holocaust story, you know, that the social studies curriculum that was in there. I believe I was in junior high school, which puts me probably around 13 or 14 years of age, when we were learning about the soap and the lampshades and the shrunken heads and all that. And by the way, that teacher punctuated his lessons with, the victors write the history books, but, you know, the victors write the history books. To me, that was meaningless. I did not comprehend the significance of that statement, because I was actually puzzled by that statement. I thought to myself, what difference does it make who writes the history books? Don't they just write the facts, right? So I was pretty naive about that one. But anyway, and then I, you know, here I am coming from German immigrant parents growing up in Canada, and I was pretty bitter and said to Mom, why didn't you do something to stop all these horrors from happening? And she just very calmly and quietly said, we didn't know until years later, you see. So she wasn't trying to tell me, oh, these things didn't happen. No, she just said, we didn't know, we didn't hear about death. We heard about the concentration camps. We knew that. She was very clear. We said, we knew there were work camps. Everybody knew there were work camps, but we didn't hear anything about death camps. We didn't hear about that till much later. So she was telling me honestly that they didn't hear about it till much later, right? So that's how it went. And then I said to Alfred on the phone earlier, very early in 2016, I said, geez, I wish I could apologize to Mom for those, my attitude to her. I was really bitter and twisted about it, you know, thinking you should have done something to stop them. Right. Yeah. As though that would be realistic. Mom was born in 1928. So when the war started, she was 11 years old. And here I'm, you know, reproaching her for not stopping these things from happening. Come on. But we lash out at the person closest to us. That's a natural human tendency. And I was pretty traumatized by the stories we learned in school. I was traumatized by that. So then Alfred saw the significance. You saw the significance of that, Alfred. You knew it right away. That's pretty significant that I'm wanting to apologize to Mom. So then when 6 months later, I went to Germany just to visit in June of 2016, and you say, okay, get to work. So I wrote down what I wanted to say. Didn't take long. And then got in front of the camera. You had all that nice equipment, green screen, a good camera, all this stuff. And even a teleprompter so that we could prepare. Because when you were making your fantastic educational videos, you know, you had a suit and tie on, and you were very professional, and you wrote out in advance what you wanted to say, right? And then you put it on your own teleprompter so that it was very professional. And they were very professionally made videos. And so I did the same with the Sorry Mom, I Was Wrong About the Holocaust. And I'll never forget the moment when you pushed that button to go out onto the internet, Alfred. Like, I felt giddy with excitement and kind of euphoric, but also I knew I was going through a door. This was kind of scary at the same time, but I felt somehow, yeah, I don't know, there was some kind of a elated but yet nervous, you know, because I knew I was going through a one-way door doing that, but little did I know what would actually happen. And I'm so glad I didn't know in advance.
Well, you know what, Monica, that going through the door, that's what every single person has to make a decision for themselves. When are they going to go through that door? And I'm not talking about uploading a video. I'm talking about just saying, blurting it out. Next time the word Holocaust comes up, you say, stop right there. Are you implying that I believe in such nonsense? That Holocaust word has to be called out anytime, anywhere you hear it. Stop it dead in its tracks. call it out. And if somebody has never done that before and are still known to be a Holocaust,
believer.
Believer. Yeah, or nutcase, that's the door they have to go through. And they'll be going through those giddy feelings like you did, because they don't know exactly what's going to come. Some, you know, but if everybody did that, can you imagine how this world would change? This entire Israel doing what it is doing, Israel is based on that lie. How hard is it to call out that lie? Come on. And that's how I talk to people now. But the Jews say, well, they believe in the Holocaust. They don't believe in Corona. Let's give them the jab. You know, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
That's what.
Anyway, yeah. So then, fast forward. That was quite remarkable. Then I did experience this thing. I learned it by experience, not by a textbook. This thing called ritual defamation. Alfred mentioned it earlier, and it is one of the tools that they use to keep their narratives going. It's, you know, a social control mechanism, and I won't go into the details now. And I'm glad I experienced it, even though it was quite trying, because it taught me, okay, this is how they do it. Nobody wanted to debate the facts or the issues. Deborah Lipstadt, that name is probably familiar to most people, because I think she's the envoy for anti-Semitism or whatever. She was the Holocaust professor, you know, and she was portrayed in that book, the movie Denial, as, and of course they take somebody who, she's not that attractive in real life, but they cast her with a very attractive woman in the movie. And then that movie was also about David Irving, who is in real life very handsome man, very handsome man. And they cast him with an ugly character, the one who was the same actor as portrayed the was the really ugly character in that Harry Potter series of movies. Like, oh my goodness. So, you know, this, how they cast things in Hollywood in the movies is really, really important to take note of, because they're always shaping our minds. They're always influencing how we think, how we perceive the world. And that's just one example. I mean, I wasn't even going to get into that, but just kind of came. But Alfred, should we talk about awakening stories for others? Because I have a couple written down here that I just am so inspired by. And they're just examples of people, how they, everybody comes to it differently. And in our time, a lot of people came through it the way we did. And the key to our awakening was 9/11. But now that's kind of old news, and younger people are, they weren't even born when 9/11 happened, and that wasn't their awakening, right? So now it's all kinds of other things, and Corona sure woke up a lot of people, and different things. Some people wake up through a more careful reading of the Bible, when in the Bible that, you know, Jesus calls out the Jews, or at the time they were maybe the Pharisees or the scribes or whatever they were called. Like, there's all kinds of different ways. Or some people bump up against the financial system in some way, and then they do some digging, and they dig, and find out, wow, this financial system, this is like a snake. That's the head of the snake, by the way, I think.
Well, why don't you give us an example of somebody? Yeah.
So there was this lovely woman, and she was a librarian, a head librarian. And after I had done, and in a town, not in my town, a different town. So I'd never met her before, but she reached out to me after my video, after we did the video, and suddenly I became a known entity. And she reached out to me and offered that, oh, they're going to do some kind of a festival the following year, and would I play my violin at this festival in the summer, like, you know, sort of like minstrel music. And I thought, this is so interesting, because everybody in my town is right now shunning me, and this woman's reaching out to me, a few towns away, right? So a little bit of a drive away, but she's reaching out to me, and she is inviting me to play at a street event. And I thought to myself right away, I thought, I wonder if she just hasn't heard about the video and all the shunning, and that, you know, maybe, or if she's, because of that, because of it, reaching out to me in some way. So anyway, a little while later, I met her, because I went to that town, and I met her, and I realized right away, yeah, that was just a front, I guess, to talk to me, to meet me. And she was wide awake. And so she told me her awakening story. And this is it, Alfred. like I say, she was a librarian. And so as a librarian, you would be going to seminars and training and different conferences where, you know, you're learning stuff and maybe not just the mechanics of being a librarian, but other things too. And I guess there was a speaker at one of these seminar events, and I don't remember what she told me about the speaker, what exactly the topic was, but it was definitely a speaker that spoke about things that didn't sit right with her. So I would imagine it was probably along the lines of, you know, maybe diversity or gender, whatever, the, you know, the LGBTQ, whatever. It was probably something that, you know, they're probably saying, you know, we have to be so inclusive of all these different whatever. And she didn't, it didn't sit right with her. So when the speech was over, instead of applauding wildly and giving this speaker a standing ovation, which everybody else in the room, because people are kind of like sheep that way too, that if they see some people standing up, they'll stand up, and everybody's applauding wildly, just giving this guy the greatest. But she didn't, because she felt, well, I'm not going to clap and give this man a standing ovation. I didn't like what he spoke about. I don't like it. It's whatever. It's just my personal taste, whatever. Okay. That's not the awakening story, but that's what happened. Then what happened was got her thinking. Her boss, I guess, called her into a meeting, and up one side, down the other, tore a strip off of her and said, why did you behave that way? You did not clap. You did not applaud for this man. And she was like shocked. Absolutely. Of course she was shocked. It's like, you're not obligated to applaud after a concert or after a speech or after whatever. If you just sit there, I mean, she didn't throw tomatoes or rotten eggs or anything. She didn't do anything. She just sat there.
That reminds me of the standing ovations that Netanyahu gets when he talks in front of the Congress in the USA. They look exactly, the first person who sits down and stops clapping, they're, you know, that's communism, pure communism. So everybody's supposed to believe, oh yeah, everything he's saying, you know, like it's a complete
that's a great little comparison, that everybody's standing up to give Netanyahu, and he got more standing ovations and applauses than anybody ever. Like,
remember, Monica, in the old Soviet Union, we used to always when we used to have this great fear of those evil communist Soviet Union, you know, way back in the 70s and so forth. And that's what we used to see there, those really, really old, decrepit, you know, Brezhnev or whatever it was. And when they talk and they're all clapping, yeah, exactly this behavior. We used to abhor that kind of stuff anyway.
Yeah. Actually, there's a lot that we used to abhor that is now more than normal here. Like, just anyway, so I was so moved and amazed and touched by that story. Just it's a real big wake up call that she got called out just because she did not applaud for a speech. It's like they could have just ignored that. So what? She has her own opinion, but head librarian, you better be on board. And they could see that she's not on board, just because she sat quietly in her chair. Anyway, she's also the woman who, we spoke a lot about all these issues, and she's the one who gave me a really good term to describe feminism. And the term that she used to describe feminism is, that's a Trojan horse. And I mean, this could be a whole nother topic for another one of our, you know, discussions that we have. It's a very, very important topic, this whole thing about the feminist agenda. But that, I just thought of that because she was the one that gave me that vocabulary to talk about.
That's very precise. That's very good. I like that too. A Trojan horse. That's an absolute Trojan horse. Like all these.
It looks so beautiful.
Yeah.
On the outside, right?
Oh yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Like equal rights for everybody and blah blah blah. The whole nonsense. You know, like we're all equal no matter what. You know,
and on that subject of looking good on the outside and not so good on the inside, that's, I would call, give that another way of describing it, is that the packaging is nice for any number of things that they have pushed on us through the years. Right, Alfred? Like, yeah, I think you muted yourself.
Yeah. Right. The packaging is really nice always. You know, like like feminism. Oh, women should be equal rights. Hey, the men are men, women are women.
The way they packaged,
yeah,
just one example of how they packaged that of course it appealed to me and all the other women, and then it would have appealed to the sensibilities of men too, that this phrase equal pay for equal work. Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? Of course it does. You know, so just things like that. But, you know, the packaging that they've given us for all these other things, like the whole gay agenda and any of the other things, that they package it nicely so that they convince us, well, of course this is good. Yeah, that sounds good. Like, we don't want to, you know, be sort of, I don't know, the stories they came up with in the beginning. And here's another one of those things that our parents were right about, Dad especially, that at that time I had arguments with Dad when this whole gay agenda started in. Of course, it starts with just being tolerant. Just be tolerant of these people. And I said to Dad, well, live and let live, love and let love. I thought, what's the harm? What's the harm? But he was very adamantly against this. You know, homosexuality stuff. And he always lectured us at the dinner table about how even just the medical side of it, how deadly and unhealthy it was, but also morally and all that stuff. And I just thought, well, just live and let live, love and let love. It's not so harmful. But actually, I have this five-step thing that they install, the plea for tolerance. That was how they started. And that's when I had my arguments with Dad. Then there's the plea for acceptance. Then there's the plea for normalization. Then there's the demand for compliance. And then it's total conquest. Those are five stages of basically, you know, the communist agenda taking over. And that's how they've done it with the whole LGBTQ thing, to the point that now they can do things in schools without parental knowledge, let alone consent. And the communist ideology of saying to the children, don't worry, we'll keep your secrets here. In other words, the children are getting this subliminal message that the parents are the enemy. How communist is that, eh?
Oh, the children are also being taught that, you know, report to us if you find, you know, if there's any resistance to
this
also. Like, we find ourselves in a deep, deep, deep communist condition right now. And that always leads to death, a massive death, okay?
Yeah.
That's a track record. So, anyway, that's where we are. So maybe we should slowly come to an end on this for today's show then. And we'll talk about,
slowly. You know,
and see how we move forward in the, you know, like maybe in the 2 weeks or something, have another one. And maybe we'll talk about, maybe we should have someone come as a guest or something, or have callers in or something. We'll go through all that then. And this was our first go at this show, right?
Yeah.
And,
we won't finish it quite yet because
we can think about wrapping
it up soon.
Right.
But yeah, we will. Here's another thing on the technical side. I know that there's probably a chat going on, and I have no idea of it. And I know that we were coached on that, and we'll get into all that in future shows. When, like we said, this is day one in school and learning the technical aspects. I know we're. That's something that we should monitor. And so thank you to all of the people who did tune in live, and they might be in the chat room. And I didn't open another tab. That's what the instructions were, to open another tab and monitor the chat so that we can respond to some of those. So we just want to say thank you to you and apologize to not responding to if there was an active chat. We're going to improve on that. We will figure all these things out, the technical parts of it. For sure. And yes, and if we will strategize, Alfred and I will, on our own time there, what we will do in our next show. And we definitely want to, you know, pull in guests, have maybe some panels, or do shows where we show clips of videos and then comment on them, that kind of thing, or invite people to comment on them and that kind of thing, and interact more with the audience. That would be the whole idea, is to interact with the audience. But Alfred, I want to tell you another little wake-up story that I learned just the other day, and this is from I think he's younger, at least that's my impression. I'm not sure. I just met him on a Twitter space or X space on that JQ radio. And then I went to see a video on his Rumble channel, and Malleus. Anyway, he was talking about what got him looking into these things for the first time. Well, he had read a letter from, and I'm going to mess up how to say the name, but an Iranian past leader, Ahmadinejad, is that the name? He was the same leader of Iran who organized that conference to discuss the Holocaust that he was so vilified in the West. But anyway, he had written a letter, and this man had read that letter. And then after he had read the letter, he heard how the mainstream media talked about the letter in the mainstream media. And he heard them saying stuff like it was incoherent, rambling, incoherent, just really belittling the letter, characterizing it in a mocking way. And he's thinking to himself, wait a minute, I read that letter and it was actually really a good letter. It was in good English. The guy knows how to speak. He's very articulate. And he thought, the mainstream media is telling me that it was incoherent. It was better English than most of my friends. So I thought, and then he started looking into, media manipulation. So that's kind of another wake up story. I think that's really, really interesting. Just these different ways that people have woken up. And I think you've muted yourself. You're trying to say something there.
No, I've unmuted myself. Yeah. You know, actually media is the central pillar of Jewish control over us, because it through the media, they call it, we can form opinions. Yeah, exactly. They tell you what you're not supposed to like. They tell you what you're supposed to hate. They tell you what you're supposed to vilify. They tell you don't go near that person or this idea because that's evil. They're telling you all that, but if we knew, the Jews say it themselves, if they, the goyim, the non-Jews are called goyim, if the goyim knew what we are doing, they would slaughter us openly in the street. They would hunt us down and kill us openly on the street. They know what they're doing, these Jews, and now their control over them, over the media and what we're they're losing it. Everybody, no matter how dumbed down they have become, is beginning to understand that what we are being served in the mainstream media is pure vomit, pure crap, and that's always everything we're seeing now is the classical symptoms of the final stages of Jewish power. And my own assessment of this is, they have taken it so over the top this time. This is Judea's final move, the last arising of this disease. And I always call it just like in every monoculture, every farmer. If you have your entire area where you live have just one single crop, then it's really only a matter of time before some bug, something will come along and destroy that crop, and then you suffer a real famine. We have a monoculture of lies and deceit run by the Jews, a monoculture of the money. The Jew is the only person in control of the money. That's their power base. And that has a digital technology enables us to liberate ourselves from their control. And they can try with their censorship and artificial intelligence and whatever they want, they will not ever regain control over this technology the way they would have to continue to keep control over us. This is, so that's where we're headed now. We're such an interesting time. Mm-hmm. And
one thing that does always give me hope, because sometimes you look around and there are a lot of things going on, things are heating up in the world, and it looks pretty, pretty darn bad. And we're not people who want to put our heads in the sand, but at the same time, I don't like to be sort of a black-pilled person, because that's where the Jews want us. Actually, the Jews want us to think there is no hope, no future. They put out movies that promote that message, and they pat themselves on the back for those kind of movies, that there is no future and no hope. And they like that. They want us to be in that state of mind, because then, you know, we're very paralyzed. Yes. If we are in that same brand. But what does actually give me genuine hope that they haven't got this all sewn up and in a bag and done and won? No, because they are so afraid of us waking up, right? That's why they do their censoring like mad. And that's why they put people in jail for the wrong think, right? And I didn't even finish that story, but I think maybe we'll just leave that for another time, that we ended up both in jail for this, you know, so-called Holocaust denial, which they, what, even just the fact that they've got these laws on the books in how many countries by now? I think it's over 20 countries by now, like European countries, Canada is included in there now. Laws that tell you you are not allowed to question the Holocaust. Even that alone, even if you didn't look at any of the evidence, and by the way, there are mountains of evidence. You know, people always have told us, oh, that's the most well-documented event in history. How can you doubt it? I say, well, yeah, they're right that it's very, very well documented, but all on the other side, our side. In other words, the evidence shows that their narrative doesn't hold up, and that's why they do not allow the evidence in court. When we went through our trial, and that could be we could talk about that more in another day, Alfred. But when we were in our trial in Germany in 2018, they did not permit our evidence, or they do not permit us to explain how we reach our conclusions, because then you're doing new crime. And in fact, Alfred spent more time in jail for things that he said and did in our trial in 2018 than they get topped up his jail sentence to even a longer time period for simply defending himself in our court case. And there's, you know, other cases where people, you know, lawyers have gone to jail in Germany for simply telling the truth, providing evidence, bringing evidence. Sylvia Stoltz is a name that comes to mind. And I mean, so many people have come up. So why do they have to make a law to enshrine history into the why do they enshrine history in law? It doesn't make any sense if you think about it, except that those who still think that that's a good thing, this is what they always told me, not always, sorry, but a few people told me this in Jasper. They said, Monica, you're the way you're talking, that's going to lead to the next Holocaust. And I said, oh, how's that? Like, how much sense does that make? So those people who still defend that there are laws on the books that prohibit you from investigating these events in history, they will defend those laws by saying that you're going to, you know, your talk is going to lead to the next Holocaust. But that begs the question about the one that they say they happened. If it, you know, did it really happen? But they are not willing to look at, did it really happen? So you're going in a circle here. Okay, well, if it didn't happen, then your statement makes no sense, but they don't want to look into it because that would be leading to the next Holocaust. So that's kind of a circular thing. So anyway, if people are in that mindset that they defend the laws that prevent us from investigating, then perhaps those people are the ones that we need to kind of just gently, kindly move out of the way, because we have work to do. We have
those people are, you know, it's like Ansundel, there came a point too where he says, I will not talk about this Holocaust anymore because everything's been said. Those people who miss, just like you don't have to tell people that the earth is not the center of the universe. That was also the law for some time. But never at any point was it actually the center of the universe, no matter how stringent the law was enforced. And that's what we have here with this thing here. We're way past that. We have got so many other things now that are so important that need to be resolved. And the one thing that will determine whether we basically all die or not is how fast we can migrate over to a money system that has any attachment to real value, like National Socialism was. It was not based on the gold standard or anything else. It was based on the working strength of the German people. And this is where our present money system is completely toxic. It is leading to a complete breakdown of our infrastructure, which we are dependent on to survive. And this is the problem right now. The Holocaust, that's watered down under the bridge. It's gone. People, I'll be very frank, Monica. Grown up people who still believe in the hollow hoax now, 2025, they're basically a lost cause, you know. And I have as much respect for them as I would to a medical doctor in a practice that is supposed to fix my broken arm or something, and he's walking around with his finger stuck up his ass, and he thinks that's the most hygienic place to keep his finger parked. I would leave that office and look for a different doctor. When somebody today still talks, even uses the word Holocaust, I walk away from that person because I cannot take them seriously. And if the reason they are behaving that way was because they didn't want to lose any friends because everybody believes in the Holocaust, they were asleep and they did not realize that even the low IQ surplus Negroes from Africa who come in here laugh themselves silly when they understand, Alfred, that some people still believe in the Holocaust. You know, I mean, that's
I'm going to tell you a little story because I have a little bit different view on that any adult that now still believes in the Holocaust, that there's no hope for them. No, I disagree. I'll just tell you a little story.
Yeah,
so
please.
This happened a couple of years ago when I was doing a little bit of a, well, I was in Alberta, and some people set up a meeting for me. And so I was the speaker. I was the guest speaker. And this was all very impromptu. I didn't go there with this plan. But when I was there, they did this. And it was great because in very short order, there were like 60 people in the room. It was in a barn on somebody's land. It was wonderful. And they wanted to hear me speak. And I would say in that room, now some of these people had been meeting since the beginning of COVID. And so they were obviously people who were concerned about what was going on, and so they were waking up about some things. COVID woke them up. Now, in that room, let's say there were 60 people. I'll just round it off. I think that's approximately correct. I would say there were half a dozen of them who already knew all about the lies about World War II. They already were in the know. I could tell they were nodding their heads all the time that I was talking, and they were, you know, body language showed me they already knew, and they're very enthusiastic. Another half a dozen people were just not going to accept it. In fact, I think a couple of people walked out. They were hostile to the message. But the rest of them, so the bulk of the people there, let's say, you know, another four dozen people, they were actually taking it in like a sponge. They were listening. But see, before that evening, they didn't know. They didn't know. So we got to give people a chance and not just completely dismiss them. They might have talked about the Holocaust like, yeah, it happened, because that's what we all learned. We all learned that. But they were open and willing to learn. And those 48 people, let's say the ones who were there lapping it up, then they asked good questions and they were eager. And you could just feel the energy in the room was electric, because I felt like I was giving them something. Like, they were grateful for hearing this. They were hungry for the truth. But yet, up until that moment, they would have been one of those people that you just characterize as they're not worth it. They are worth it if they are open to it. But we all have to learn. We all start somewhere, right? Like, we all start somewhere. And so if some people have learned about COVID, you're muted and you're wanting to talk. Go ahead.
How long ago was that?
Well, that was less than 2 years ago. I mean, it was well after COVID started. So it's really just in recent times, yeah. Alfred. They are hungry for the information. Those are the people we want to reach. I feel that we need to reach those people who are just starting to open their eyes. But Holocaust is the most taboo of these two subjects. So I think we need to, you know, welcome those people into the fold if they've just seen part of the picture with something else, another one of these.
Well, I welcome it in the fold this way. I say, if you still believed it, then don't ever say that you believed it in my presence, because it's so embarrassing. Yeah. I make it very clear. That's embarrassing. It really is embarrassing. Like the doctor who got his finger stuck up his ass, somebody should tell him. If somebody hasn't told him and he still thinks that's a good place to keep his finger, good for him. But don't say in my company that you believed that, okay? Pretend that you knew that a long time ago. Monica, it's really, the time is up. I will not talk about that anymore. It's over.
Absolutely.
He said he took that attitude like a long time ago already. You know, like, we got 2025 now, and that subject is over. It's gone. I have nothing but contempt for people. Oh, I won't tell them in their face I have contempt for them if they are understanding how dumb they've been. I mean, it's like,
or you know, that really, they want to know. If people
being an adult entails some responsibility. You should have some modicum of interest. What's going on around the world? And somebody who says, "Well, nobody told me what the, you know." Like this is a
no. But if they want to come out of it,
don't waste too much time because they're not going to be the ones who are going to be much of a help. Because if they take that long to learn that. You know, like let them go. Let them like little children playing on the side of the road or something. Like, you know, really, my patience is over with these people. It just is. I just say it the way it is. You know, my patience is over. It's like
Anselm, well, he says, I can't blame you.
Yeah.
Can't blame you. We've both, you know, like okay, you get sent to prison, then you get put into solitary confinement for 558 days because you refused the mask, and so you know. Nobody can blame anybody losing patience.
And all of those things. I says, you know, at the time, sure, that was gruesome and hard. There's an old saying in German. It goes that often you can only see that what you thought was bad luck was actually your best luck that you ever had. You know, and me being in solitary confinement all the time was actually good luck because you know, when you're in prison, I was very, very well liked and respected by the prisoners and the guards. After, you know, when they learned what, like at the end of my 4 years, they're all saying, Schaefer was right. Schaefer was right. And they're telling me the guards were saying, don't come back in here. We need you outside. And the prisoners anyway. But like Leslie Borey will tell you, he was attacked and beaten up and so forth in prison. But it's not because that person who did that to him didn't like him. That person was like a paid assassin, if you will. Okay, he didn't even know Leslie Borey, but he did it because somebody promised him some kind of money on the other side when they get the news that Leslie is dead or seriously injured. You know, that's how they do it. You know. And my time, even in isolation mode there, I was in that the whole COVID corona time. I was in the prison and I remember seeing the propaganda and it says, wow, a lot of people are going to roll up their sleeve because, well, they believe in the hollow hoax. Now they're going to believe in the corona. They're going to roll up their sleeve. I feel sorry for all these people. I was right in the right place at the right time. Like I said, when they came to my cell, you know, Mr. Schaefer, would you like an appointment for your vaccine? And they says, you know, in a calm voice, because I knew it was coming, I says, you know, the doctor that comes too close to me with that needle won't have any teeth anymore because I'm going to punch him out. And they says, Mr. Schaefer, don't be so violent. I says, it's just self-defense, purely self-defense. And like I said, when I was released out of that prison, all the guards were saying, Schaefer was right. The prisoners were saying, listen to Schaefer when he's talking, you know. Just listen to what he's saying. He's right, you know?
Yeah, so, fantastic. You know, that's fantastic.
And if people want to believe in the Holocaust, they can believe in Corona, roll up their sleeve and take their injection, disappear and die. Well, no one's going to miss you, okay? It's like the bird that tweets dumb stuff instead of flying with his God-given wings when the cat comes, turns into cat shit. There is a certain minimum of intelligence that we should be in possession of to still be alive. Our ancestors, you know, these people that still believe in the Holocaust, hollow hoax now, 2025, I don't know how they can still be alive because normally they should have been filtered out a long time ago. That I'm sorry to be so harsh, but that's how it is, you know. And I'll leave that.
Our ancestors are rolling in their graves.
I say, Monica, it's not up to you or me to reach those people that still haven't made that first step. It really isn't. They don't even interest us. They can.
I wasn't talking about the people making a first step, Alfred. I'm talking about the people who are now curious. They've kind of opened their eyes, and now they just want to know. So that's all. I was not talking about the people who are completely in, you know, hopeless. They've rolled up their sleeves. No, these people in that room, in that barn, they were people who were gathering since a few years. The COVID thing got them kind of going, whoa, something wrong with this. And so they were people who were resisting already, but they hadn't yet figured it out about Holocaust because they had, like, they were busy looking at Corona stuff. So that's all, Alfred. I'm not talking about the total zombies. But anyway, on that note of you – you know, when you were leaving prison and they were all saying in one voice, Schaefer was right. I think that would be a good place to wrap it up for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, just the respect that was shown to you. And also to me, the 10 months that I spent in jail, there was a very big transformation of how I got treated. In the beginning, I was that neo-Nazi on the block that had to get extra special in quotation marks treatment, and I mean, you know, extra kind of humiliation, extra ooh, I know, we know what you did, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, yeah,
and then in the end,
yeah, I
treated
want to
with respect.
You know, I
treated
want to
with respect.
You broke the ice for me. You were in prison for our listeners. You went in there 6 months before I was sent, brought into prison. Okay, that's why the trial started one day before the 6 months was over, because they would have had to release you. They can't keep you more than 6 months without the trial beginning. So that's when the first day of the court trial happened for us. And then I was arrested immediately in the courtroom and so forth because it's Inquisition. But you had broken the ice, and I was very thankful for that. I mean, how many guys have a sister that will actually go into prison to break the ice for them? I mean, thank you, Monica. I appreciate that to this very day, you know.
So, oh, that's good, Alfred.
And anyway, I always say our prison sentence really began with your arrest, and it ended with my release. So that's a total of actually exactly 5 years. See, I spent 4.5 years in prison, and the half year that's missing to make up the five is when you were in prison. So we had five years in prison, Monica.
In together, combined,
together,
because we do consider ourselves a team. That's why we're doing this show called Those Darn Schaefer Kids.
Yeah.
And as you see, we don't always have the same style, but we do work together and we amplify each other's message. And neither Alfred nor I could have done this and been as strong of individuals as we are as a team.
Absolutely.
And we have both said that to each other and about each other, that I appreciate so much what my brother has enabled me to go down this path and have the courage and whatnot to do what I'm doing. And very graciously, you've kind of returned the compliment to me, Alfred, which I really appreciate, because I always have seen you as the leader in this, and I'm just going to pay respect where respect is due. So thank you so much. And I want to say thank you to all our listeners, and we will be back. We will do it on the Wednesday again, but it probably won't be next Wednesday. We're thinking we're going to do it bi-weekly, like every second week. And again, we will post that as an upcoming show then on the FTJ Media. And so I hope you all enjoyed today's. And that's, oh, actually, you know what? People, when we get interviewed by others, they remind us to tell them where they can find us and all that stuff. And I forget these things, but now that we're doing this on our own, we should promote stuff. Like you held up that book earlier that people can, I've written a book called Sorry Mom, I Was Wrong About the Holocaust, same title as that little video, Sorry Mom, I Was Wrong About the Holocaust. And that is from the Barnes Review. That's where you can get it. It has been translated into French and German.
Yeah, here's the German version right here. See, there's Sorry, Tut mir leid, Mutti. Tut mir leid, Mutti. Auch ich glaubte an den Holo Schwindel, you know. Sorry, Tut mir leid, sorry, Mom, but even I believe the Holo Swindle, you know.
Yeah,
so this is a bit more hardcore,
the
title, and it's a bit bit more content. It's really good. I think it's so important, because that book basically outlines my dear Monica, my sister there, the ritual defamation that she went through, and it shows you through her experience all the tricks that they used to, you know, to keep us down and so forth. And what you're saying before about the team, that it is unimaginable the power that we would have, we white people, European people, when we have figured this out, and we are figuring this out in overdrive right now. So don't be the last on your block to come and join our team. And believe me, no matter what team you're on, you would not want to be on the opposing team against us, because we're going to lick them.
We're strong.
Easy.
Our
we're
people
strong.
Have been down
we have
on
always,
before. And
Yeah. We always do show our best performance with our backs against the wall, okay, when there's no more choice, when we realize life is not about playing silly games and believing silly nonsense. No, this is a life and death struggle. And by God, we're not doing this to lose. We're doing this to win. And we're going to win. Easy. Okay, let's just call it a day then, Monica. It's been a real slice. It's been a real pleasure. And we'll post when our next meeting will be. We'll do all that technical stuff in the coming days. And to our audience, looking forward to talking to you again. Okay? Cheerio.
Thank you, everybody.
Okay, I'm going to stop live
stream. Thanks, Alfred,
there we go.
Setting that up.